Good afternoon. I call this meeting of Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy to order. Members, welcome back to the hybrid meeting. I think we're getting used to it, a little bit of the mic and the volume on the other side. So for those who are online, please make sure that you're muted and you should get recognized before you speak. And this remote hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. It's also hybrid in person. This remote hearing can be viewed on the House webcast. I would like to ask the Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Badri, to now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor, present. Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang, present. Lead Hamilton.
Present.
Lead Hamilton, present. Baker. Baker. Dabney.
Dabney, present.
Dabney, present. Frankie.
Frankie, present.
Frankie, present. Greenman.
Present.
Greenman, present. Haley. Haley. Juergens.
Juergens, present.
Cagle.
Present.
Cagle, present. Katiza Watun.
Katiza Watun, present.
Katiza Watun, present. Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Zhang. Zhang.
Present.
Zhang, present. Baker.
Present.
Baker, present. Haley.
Haley, present.
Haley, present. Chair Noor, we have a quorum.
Members, there's a quorum present. With that, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 23rd, 2022. I've had two places. Representative Baker moves the approval for minutes for March 23rd, 2022. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for March 23rd, 2022 are now adopted. With that, members, we have several bills today, and we will try to stick to time. So the testifiers and the bill authors have already been notified of the timeline. We will start with House File 1332. Representative Hart, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill. I'll move House File 1332 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present House File 1332 today. This file creates the Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program. The bill uses the term regenerative food web that refers to a system of producing, transporting, and distributing food that stands in contrast to the industrial food economy that we have now. The bill supports each component of a regenerative food web, which includes producers, storage, and delivery systems in neighborhood food hubs. The purpose of this program is to provide an alternative to the industrial food economy by establishing and maintaining local and regional regenerative food webs to address in a sustainable manner the enduring challenges of food, water, and climate. There are three main provisions to the bill. The first establishes an advisory committee to advise the deed commissioner. The second provides a list of things deeds can do to achieve the purpose of the program around financial and technical assistance. And the third requests an appropriation for this work. Mr. Chair, I want to be brief. I just want to make two quick comments about this bill. It is important to note that over the past 50 years, local agriculture has seen a dramatic decrease, and it has become very difficult for local people to access local foods. A local food economy is not just about the food. It's about opportunity and economic sustainability. The more we can support local businesses, the more we can build local wealth. Every dollar we spend in a local business has a big impact on our local economy. According to the American Independent Business Alliance, on average, 48% of each purchase at a local independent business was recirculated locally, compared to less than 14% of purchases at chain stores. Furthermore, regenerative practices means that we will be able to use our land in a way that will benefit the environment. A viable, low-cost way to reverse climate change is through soil. When cared for properly, soil has the potential to sequester 100% of the carbon dioxide that humans have emitted into the atmosphere. Our modern, industrialized, monocrop-based agriculture is killing the microbial life in the soil that does the carbon sequestering. New agriculture called regenerative farming will increase soil life, store water, and sequester CO2. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have two testifiers here today to speak in support of the bill, and I have an order of them, but Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to you to call on our testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative Howard. The first testifier is Marita Buhol. Welcome. Please sit at the front there and...
Does it matter which microphone?
Doesn't matter. Maybe in the middle will be much better. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, rather good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Marita Bougeau. May I begin?
Yes.
Okay. I'm a native of Duluth. Our family home was a 10-minute walk from the shores of Lake Superior. I made that walk countless times during my youth, in all seasons and weather conditions. In the brief time we have here today, it would be impossible to share all that I witnessed and learned from those visits and from living in a region so profoundly influenced by the lake's ecosystems. What I can tell you is that I'm here today because I know what we all know, that our story, our collective story, is tied to Lake Superior and to the Mississippi River and to the thousands of lakes and streams that sustain the life of urban, rural, and suburban communities across the state. Ecosystem health is directly connected to the health of our communities and our capacity to produce food and drink clean water. We are the stewards of those priceless ecosystems. I think we can agree that no one else can do the work of caring for our home. Yet today, our communities are tethered to a publicly funded industrial food economy created by the Farm Bill that by design depends on practices that extract and destroy ecosystems, contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, create dependency, and produce waste. The ecological, economic, and human health impacts of the industry's operations are neither a mystery nor are they news. The only conclusion we can draw is this. We have a publicly funded food economy, just not the one we need to fulfill our role as stewards. The good news is that we do know what we need to do to shape a responsive, just, and sustainable food economy. Working in partnership with nature remains the tried and proven strategy for yielding abundant sources of food and clean water and capturing carbon. The economy created by the Headwaters Community Food and Water Bill is designed to build on those proven strategies. It provides the economic infrastructure to create and operate a robust, locally adapted source-to-table system designed to produce, cook, preserve, deliver, and store food in our communities. It would employ community members in a circular economy whose revenue will remain in the community for the benefit of the employees and the region. The design and operations of the food web can be guided by the experience and leadership of local food initiatives, which have emerged in recent years in response to the absence of a just food system and real food insecurity. They have trained farmers and cooks, established youth leadership and food sovereignty programs, and established food hubs. With economic infrastructure provided by this bill, the work of those initiatives can thrive, and we can build great capacity across the state to have regional food systems that will supply all that we need and be a foundation for resilient economies. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bougeau, for your testimony. If you can wait there, just in case of any questions that may come up. The next person is Ms. Dean. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. I am Jeanette Dean, representing the MIN 350 Action Food Systems Team and Policy Action Team as a volunteer and member of MIN 350, which has over 30,000 members. Due to limited time for testimony, I also encourage you to read our letter of support with more details, links, and economics figures. Our Min 350 action campaign for the Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program has 13 coalition partners and over 370 pledge signers ready to support the bill and the program further with action and help in their local areas. It is imperative that the Headwaters Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program be passed. This will be used to provide sufficient funding for state and regional existing initiatives and local initiatives to faster create a statewide source-to-table food web economy. This will also greatly help to increase the number of related and needed career and job opportunities and prevent any delays in the urgent work required by unnecessarily reinventing the wheel. The most important legislative plans that currently justify and mandate a statewide approach and immediate funding are, one, the House Select Committee on Racial Justice recommended supporting the program in their report to the legislature. Two, the House Climate Action Plan provided a $1 billion spending plan that does not yet include adequate funding for a key area, which is enhanced local food systems. Three, the Minnesota Climate Action Framework has several goals, including Initiative 2.5 to support local food. Food produced and consumed locally can reduce emissions. It can also support local farmers and entrepreneurs, promoting economic vitality and providing underserved communities with access to healthy, fresh food and economic opportunities. Lastly, to provide solid funding this important year, perhaps a minimum of $50 million could be spent for each of the 6 planning zones or each of the 11 economic development regions, which should, of course, include Minnesota's tribes within each. Funding for this bill should match other substantial amounts in the tens of millions that are being wisely invested in the current Minnesota Climate Action Funding Summary. I and others look forward to talking with you further. Thank you, honorable committee members.
Thank you so much, Ms. Dean, for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. Blake. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed. The next person on the list is Sola Bear. So if Daryl Lindsay. All right. The last person also who registered is Roxanne O'Brien. Let us know if there's any technical issues online.
Okay. No technical issues. I didn't comb my hair today. I'm sorry to scoff.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. O'Brien. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay, my name is Roxanne O'Brien. I represent my community, North Minneapolis, but also a coalition of people that we call ourselves Community Members for Environmental Justice. And we've been doing work, some of us have been doing work longer than others, but for about 10 years, we've been working on environmental justice. And I know a lot of people know me as someone who fights against pollution, but I want to talk today about the fact that I didn't get into this work until I had heard that people's gardens in my community were at risk if they were going to eat their vegetables. The soil was so toxic with lead that they would have a 50% chance of getting cancer just by eating their vegetables out of their garden. So that's why I started in this work, because I know my community is working hard at being more healthier and being stronger and protective of each other. So when I met Marita, I met her through an EJ organizer, an EJ elder, who has been with me in the work for a while. And he connected me with her. And as she started to, thank you, Marita, for doing this important work, putting this together, because when she started to tell me about this bill, one of the things that I loved about it was that it was something that people from different communities and different walks of life could come together and agree on, which is really important in this world, that we find more common interests with each other. And one of our biggest interests is, you know, we all drink water, we all eat food, we all have loved ones that we care about, that, you know, these are just basic psychological needs that people can agree on, that we all need in order to be alive and be well. And so another thing was the fact that it was bringing together different parts of the community, rural communities, you know, farmers out there who are going through hard times. There's a lot of there's a higher suicide rate among farmers right now. And this would also bring together people in urban areas. So rural areas, urban areas, indigenous communities. I thought it was a win-win to work together to do something that we all could agree on. So to close out, one of the biggest parts of this bill that I think is important for us to know, that the food industry right now isn't sustainable for us. And if we love our water, which I know we do, we need our water to grow our foods as well, I think we should take that into account. This should be a no-brainer in passing this bill, because we can't continue to allow the food industry to use, you know, 80% of our drinking water and only produce, you know, 30% of the world's food. Meanwhile, we have indigenous people, people who are regenerative farmers, urban farmers, rural farmers, who are doing agriculture in a way that's in alignment with our earth and with our communities. And I think we would really miss an opportunity for the future of our communities if we won't pass this bill. So I know that I'm really excited that we have a lot of authors, new authors, on this bill, and I just want to say I appreciate everyone for coming together and supporting this bill. We support this bill at Community Members for Environmental Justice, and we just appreciate everyone for working hard on this. So thank you. I know I only have 2 minutes.
Thank you so much, Ms. O'Brien, for your testimony. Members, any discussion? Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for the bill. I have a question here about line 3.1, and then I'll refer back to, if you go back to line 2.1, subdivision 3, the commissioner must achieve the purpose in subdivision 2 through multiple methods, including but not limited to, and then we go through these, and then, so we must provide, and then it says, provide affordable and accessible health care for every member of the food web economy to ensure that the system is economically robust and can operate effectively. I'm just wondering, is DEED really the organization that is set up to do this? And then how far into the food web are we talking about, and how are we going to achieve through this bill affordable and accessible health care for the people that are providing these services?
Representative Herr.
Mr. Chair and Representative Frankie, so thank you for the question. I'll speak a little bit to this, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Bougeau in case she wants to add to this. But I think that every individual who participates in this, right, will not be a part of a large system. And so, like, individual farmers or people who are providing the transport, you know, they all deserve health care as well. And you're right, there is this the best place to put this? I think that we are always open to suggestions to what we may how we may amend the bill in order to make it more executable by the different entities that would be involved. And so I'm open to any suggestions that we may have, and I think that it is really important for us as we create systems to ensure that people also have the benefits they need in order to maintain and sustain that system. Ms. Bougeau, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Ms. Bougeau?
So the need for health care obviously is something that all of us have. We already know that farmers right now struggle to get affordable health care. And so including that as an important feature of the bill seemed pretty obvious. Members of the food web economy, I think, would need to all have access to health care. And the leadership from the Office of DEED would be largely in creating the food web system itself and making it possible for the programs to exist. As Representative Herr said, how the healthcare is actually accessed may also have to be connected to whatever else is already being done in the state. We wanted to highlight that this is a real need that's not being met at the moment, and not only for farmers, but for other people who are low income who would work in the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that answer. So I guess that kind of we don't know, Mr. Chair, how we're going to do that. We're just going to figure that out later. So, no, I agree on the health care issue. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Go for it, Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Herr, when you go to line 3.3, the Section 11 here, provide financial subsidy to make fruits and vegetables affordable for all income levels. But then there's no fiscal appropriation in this bill. Are we saying that, I guess my question would be, are we going to be paying the farmers, and whether they're urban or not, or outstate, large, small, are we going to be subsidizing through this program or through other programs that are already in existence?
Representative Herr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, so we already currently subsidize agriculture right now. We're just asking that that for us to also subsidize this in no different way than we currently subsidize the agriculture economy right now, and to ensure that people have affordable access to this. We do not have an appropriation specifically requested because we also, you know, at that time didn't know the committee's targets or what would be considered appropriate to ask. And so we can work on that further to provide what that fiscal, what the appropriation should be. And Ms. Bougeau, do you have anything else you want to add to that?
Well, the fact that...
Ms. Bougeau.
Oh, excuse me. The fact that we do subsidize other products that are part of the industry is really clear. And we don't subsidize in any way production for fruits and vegetables. Local producers face significant barriers for production and delivery of the products that they create here, whether it's locally sourced meats or vegetables and fruits. And so it seemed important that we highlight the need to actually provide investment in that in order for their work to be doable and for them to be able to have a living as well. Not to mention the fact that many people cannot afford fruits and vegetables. Of course, that's part of a larger problem of people not having adequate income to be able to manage both living expenses as well as affording groceries. And this committee is not going to actually solve that problem. But investing in a system that actually provides affordable, healthy food seems like a really wise investment overall.
So with that, I'll give Representative Jorgens, and then followed by Baker, and that will end.
If I could just make one more quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Well, 5 seconds, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna suggest to Representative Herr, maybe look at the market box system That's a great program that helps people to get fresh fruits and vegetables through.
Yeah, we're aware of that program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, anybody that's been around this place for the last few years knows that I've been a champion of addressing food insecurity, especially with relation to children. I championed the bill to finally outlaw the practice of dumping a child's lunch in the garbage if they have a negative balance on their lunch account. So this is something that's very important to me. And so, Representative Herr, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward, but I have some questions on some of the language. Line 2.21 says, provide financial and technical assistance to establish rights of personhood for ecosystems that sustain life, including the right to live and thrive. That sounds to me like we're giving human rights to a plant. Can somebody please help me understand that?
Ms. Mijal.
So there is a movement now that you may or may not have heard about for rights of nature. And I believe that it's in response in large part to the fact that all of us know stories of our water, our soil being polluted by legal practices. I mean, it's legal to apply a toxic chemical in order to grow on an industrial scale. And the residue, the byproduct of that is toxic soil and water. Many of our communities across Minnesota actually don't have access to drinkable water as a result of that. So the idea of responding by providing rights for nature may seem unusual, but I think we may need to think about how are we going to protect our ecosystems so that we have the food to eat and the water we need to drink. And this is one way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Frankie and I can both appreciate that. We live in an area of the Southeast Metro that has been contaminated with PFAS in the water. So definitely understand the downsides of that, the effects that that can have. But establishing rights of personhood for ecosystems, that seems to me to be very flawed language to have in a bill. Further, on line 2.23, 2.24, facilitate enhancement of the legal rights of nature and the ecosystems that sustain life. That's furthering that to actually give the legal rights to plants and animals. If this were to become law, to me, I read that as saying a tree would have more legal rights than that of an unborn baby. And I find that very problematic to put that into the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair, maybe to the author. Why, Representative, did you choose DEED to administer this program versus the Department of Agriculture? It just doesn't seem like the right fit. I'd like to have your thoughts on that.
With your closing remarks, Representative Hart.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, and thank you for the opportunity to bring the bill in front of you. Representative Baker, I'm just, we are open to any changes that we may need to in order to make this bill amenable to the group. And so we are open to looking at ag instead, but we do see that in this food web system, we are creating new jobs, new systems, new workforces. And so we thought this might be the place for us to put this in. But do appreciate that, and I would be more than willing, open to talking offline with you on how you could see this going through ag versus DEED. And so I'd love to touch base with you outside of this. I did just want to address really quick Representative Jergens' comment about personhood. I want to remind us that we as a country have decided that companies are people. I don't see how this is any different than saying that then the most precious resources, our water, our soil, should also have the right to be able to live and sustain so that we can live and sustain. Corporations provide jobs. But if corporations didn't exist, I mean, we would have negative consequences to that, but our lives wouldn't depend on it. If we don't have water and soil and air that is clean, we don't exist. And so I think that for us to remember what we've already decided as a society, who gets to be a person and who doesn't. And so with that, members, I do ask for you to support this bill and include it into your report, your committee report, and I hope for support of this committee.
Thank you so much. I renew my motion that House File 1332 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, we move to House File 4488. Representative Carr, please introduce your bill. I will move that House File 4488 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome back, Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back. I do have an author's amendment to House File 4488. Would you like me to talk about the bill first or move the amendment?
So Representative Carr has got DE2 amendment. Can you please describe, I'll move DE2 amendment. Can you please describe it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this amendment is actually short and simple. This bill is actually short and simple. So instead of submitting an amendment to address the clarifying language, the DE made it cleaner. It adds clarifying language on how the funds will be used and reporting for accountability. It just puts the bill in its proper form.
Thank you. With that, members, since this DE2 puts the bill in the shape the author wants, any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, DE2 is adopted. To your amended bill, Representative Hart.
Thank you, Chair Norrie, committee members, for allowing me to speak to House File 4488 today. This bill is getting introduced at a critical time for Asian American, Asian Minnesotan communities. The economic foundation of our communities is shaky right now. Due to the combined effects of rising anti-Asian hate and the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on our communities, the time is now for meaningful investment in the economic recovery and resiliency of Asian Minnesotans. This month marks the one-year anniversary of the devastating Atlanta spa shooting in which 8 people, including 6 six Asian women, were shot and killed. Several House members joined me last week for an event sponsored by Kale in memory of the lives that were lost that day. 1 year later, very little has changed. Almost every week, we see yet another story of an incident of violence or harassment against an Asian American individual, most often Asian American women and our elderly population. And what doesn't reach the headlines are the dozens of threats, racial slurs, and other forms of verbal harassment and intimidation that Asian Minnesotans are experiencing every day. This harmful climate undermines both the safety and the economic stability and well-being of our community. Our small businesses can't rebuild out of the COVID pandemic when their safety is threatened. Our nonprofits are overstretched providing support for health, housing, and other needs, while also aiding their clients in responding to hate incidents. As incidents of Asian hate continues to rise, our communities are also struggling with the economic impact of the pandemic itself. Our small businesses, the economic engine of Asian Minnesotan communities, have struggled to keep their doors open. Asian Minnesotans are also more likely to work in frontline jobs, the jobs that have been most at risk for COVID. 40% of Asian Minnesotans work in high-risk frontline jobs, the highest of any population group in the state. And in addition to the incidence of hate, the APA has seen an increase in, as I stated earlier, in some of the things that we don't track, right, which we might list as microaggressions. And I just want to share really quick that this past year, I contracted COVID. And I actually was hospitalized because I have a kidney disease. And in my stay, I was never seen by the hospital, and I stayed there an entire night. And instead of admitting that, like, I was just somebody they did not see, that did not treat, whether it is that they had biases around who was coming, I saw everybody else getting treated and leave. And when my husband called in the morning to find out what had happened to me, instead of being honest about what had happened, they lied and said I had left the ER, which I was still in the ER. And then in addition to that, after hanging up on him and him calling back, they said that I had refused treatment, which was not true. And I think about this day very much so that this is why we as AAPI communities, we understand that we are hyper invisible. And so when we receive disproportionate hate or exclusion from everyday things that we should actually be participating in, no one sees us and nobody then is there to help us through these issues. And so I just wanted to lift up that particular story because I think about the fact that numerous people that came into that ER, I was the only person that got left in a room and was not treated and was never seen by anybody. So I want to say that with this bill, it invests directly in Asian Minnesotan communities to support economic recovery and resiliency in the context of hate incidents and COVID-19. The bill appropriates $1 million to Coalition of Asian American Leaders, a trusted organization with a strong track record of conducting research related to the health and economic well-being of Asian Minnesotans, as well as a robust network of 5,000 community leaders, nonprofits, and small businesses across the state. So Specifically, this bill will invest in Kale to provide direct re-grants to small Asian Minnesota nonprofits and businesses, conduct outreach, and provide technical assistance to Asian nonprofits and businesses to respond to incidents of hate and to navigate government programs and grant opportunities related to economic recovery, and conduct and disseminate research related to the employment, economic, and challenges of Asian Minnesotan communities in the context of COVID recovery. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have testifiers here today to speak, and if you are okay, I will yield the time to Tao-Mei Zhang, the Executive Director and Network Director of Coalition of Asian American Leaders.
Tao-Mei Zhang, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tao-Mei Zhang. I'm the Executive and Network Director for the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. I want to thank our chief bill author, Representative Gao Liher, for bringing this bill forward. A little bit about CAL. CAL is a cross-sector, cross-ethnic, and cross-generational network of over 5,000 Asian Minnesotans who work to harness the collective power of our communities. I'm here to share why this bill is critical to the economic stability of Asian Minnesotans. Right now, our communities are in great need. Our nonprofits, small businesses, workers, students, and our families are struggling due to the continuing impacts of COVID-19 and the disturbing rise in violence directed at Asian Minnesotans. Last year, CAL released a report that revealed major disparities in COVID infection rates. The report showed that while Asian Minnesotans make up 5% of the state's population, they represent 8% of COVID-19 ICU cases in 2020. When we disaggregated the data, we found that Hmong, Karen, and Karni had the highest rates of infection and mortality. In fact, nearly half of all COVID-19 deaths in the Asian Minnesotan community were Hmong. I'm just gonna repeat that one more time. Nearly half of all COVID-19 deaths in the Asian Minnesotan community were Hmong. In my own family, we lost 5 people due to COVID. We didn't just lose mothers and fathers, we lost heads of households who are often the main breadwinners of these families. The number of high deaths in the community have serious economic consequences. Not only were families impacted by COVID, our businesses were too. Small businesses are often the lifeblood of many Asian Minnesotan communities, and they're continuing to struggle as other businesses rebound from COVID-19. During the pandemic, CAL conducted a specific survey of Asian-owned small businesses and their experiences, and this is what we learned. 43% of Asian small businesses were unable to pay for their bills. 50% of Asian small businesses had to either reduce their business hours or temporarily close. The small business owners we surveyed also were clear about a few things. They told us direct legislative support is critical, as well as technical assistance, language access, and training to ensure that they can access government programs and grants to help keep their businesses open. Throughout the country, we've seen elected officials respond to this moment with transformative investments in our Asian American communities to support our health, safety, and economic recovery. With the historic $9 billion surplus in Minnesota, meaningful investment is needed to build economic resiliency in the Asian Minnesotan community. This bill will leverage CAL's skills, resources, and network to immediately invest in our nonprofits, our small businesses, and our families who need these resources the most. I urge you to support this bill, and I thank you for the time to be able to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tao-Mei Zhang. The next person is Fan, and also I see Mr. Yang already up front there. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Wei Fan, and thank you, Chair No and members of committees. I'm the Executive Director of Vietnamese Social Services of Minnesota, and I'm here speaking in support of HF 4488. We are a small, culturally Pacific organization founded in 1987. We serve over 4,000 refugees and immigrants annually who are elders, small businesses, and job seekers. We believe in systematic change through the voices of our communities. This is why I am proud that we are here to testify on the critical role that Cal has played in building the capacity of historically neglected and marginalized groups. Over the years, we have witnessed how Cal authentically amplifies all voices so that our services can be responsive, proactive, and impactful. In 2020, CALS provide us two rounds of funding to allow us to respond to the impact of COVID-19. This included support for over 50 nail salon businesses to connect them to government resources and help them understand new COVID OSHA requirements so that they can reopen their businesses. This past year, within the climate of anti-Asian hate, our office was vandalized and broken into several times. Our agency van was stolen, and our security fence was destroyed. This has required us to use funding originally allocated for community initiatives to instead be spent on repairs. Anti-Asian hate and COVID-19 has created greater economic needs for us and other nonprofits. This is why we believe that an organization like CAL, who is trusted in the community and has strong relationships with government agencies, can bring everyone together to help us find solutions that center the community. CAL leadership as a nonprofit intermediary has played a significant role in garnering support for us and building our capacity. They have always fought for the little guys. They have listened and acted with equity in their redistribution of resources. Most of all, they are an authentic community connector, building lasting relationships with community groups. This is why we fully support HF 4488 for CAL. When you invest in CAL, you invest in us. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fa, for your testimony. Mr. Yang, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Yang. I am the chair for the Minnesota Hmong Chamber of Commerce. On behalf of the Hmong Chamber, I support HF 4488. In addition to being the chair of the Hmong Chamber, I also am still currently serving in the United States Air Force Reserve. My dedication to serving my country is the same dedication that brings me here today to serve my community, a dedication that is common among many small business owners. Our businesses serve the needs of our community, but many entrepreneurs and business operators need support to grow and thrive. In my role as a small business owner in Minnesota and the chair for the Hmong Chamber of Commerce, I know at firsthand the struggles that Southeast Asian-owned businesses are experiencing, especially because of the pandemic and the rise in anti-Asian hate. There are many businesses asking for loan assistance, many are closing down for good, and many selling their business because it is no longer profitable. There is now an even greater need for help with these businesses back on their feet, with linguistically accessible technical support and funding that is responsive to the needs of small businesses. This is a make or break time for us. With proper assistance, we can help businesses learn how to navigate the challenges of our time and thrive. We support this bill to provide CAL funding to help our businesses in time of great need. CAL has always been a strong part of the Hmong Chamber, and together we have collaborated to provide assistance to small businesses in need during the pandemic. We trust CAL. CAL is an anchor in our community, and they understand the important role that our Asian small businesses play in the wealth and economic vibrancy of our state. There is no other nonprofit organization in Minnesota like CAL that has a relationship with both the government leaders and the community. This is why we believe CAL is the right organization to create the greatest impact for our communities and small businesses. For this reason and many more, we support HF 4488. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Yang, for your service and for the work that you do for these small businesses. With that, members, any discussion? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr, for the bill. I'm curious, what measurements would be used to track how this money is spent and what the results are? What are the deliverables? And I guess really what I want to know is how will we know if it's successful after this after the money is appropriated?
Representative Hart.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you for the question, Representative Jergens. We did include, that's why the DE was important, is that we did include that, you just read here on lines 1.11 through 1.13, that CAIL will issue a report on the outcomes of the grant to the Commission of Employment and Economic Development by December 15th of 2024. We don't know exactly, we didn't make that very prescriptive because we knew that there would be many things, and since we're asking the grant for research, for grants, for outreach or technical assistance, that those pieces will require time to pull the data together, and that that report will have a comprehensive look at who it was impact, the number of people impacted, things of that nature that will be included in that report. And so CAIL will be responsible for ensuring that all the pieces that they're requesting the funds for would be reported on back to DEED.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I read in the DE that there is a report, but it doesn't specify what's in the report. And I just want to, as with most things that come through here, we want to be able to track it and find out what are the most successful programs, what are they doing right that is successful, what are they doing that wasn't as successful, and how can we learn from that. So the key is actually what's in the report, and I so that's what I wanted to ask. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vice Chair Jay Zhong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank the bill author, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill forward. Over the last few years, I've had the opportunity to visit with many small mom-and-pop shops, especially here in the metro, and there is definitely a big need for this. So I really appreciate what you're doing, Representative Herr, and to the Coalition of Asian American Leaders for pushing this bill forward. If there's anything I can do to help you, we're moving forward, please let me know.
Any further discussion, members? To the bill author, Representative Parr, for your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Noor, committee, for allowing us to share this bill and bring it presented in front of you. And I am open to working with Representative Jergens. If there are specific things that we should be including in that report, we'd be more than willing to entertain that and include that in the information. But I do just ask that this is a really critical time and for the committee to support this. And I just ask for it to be included in your report for the committee.
All right. With that, I renew my motion that House File 4488 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. We are moving on to Representative Agbaje's Bill 4319. This is only for informational hearing. We'll be sending the recommendation to the capital investment. Representative Agbaje, Vice Chair Agbaje, welcome to the committee, and please introduce your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's always good to be back in front of you. House File 4319 is a project meant to provide an opportunity to a living wage paying job to more members of the metro area. The project seeks funding for $4 million to renovate an existing building to create a training center for engineering and technical jobs in the solar energy and wind energy sector. The training center is located at the heart of North Minneapolis and is accessible to more people who traditionally would not have access to such training. The additional use of these funds is to engage in planning for a second lot of land owned by Northgate for the expansion of the training center. Northgate Development has a vision of creating a training facility that can be used by varied partners in the business, nonprofit, or trade sectors. It will be a multifaceted facility that will have the tools necessary for different partners to come in and offer their expertise and training to a community that desperately needs it. The focus on renewable energy is to ensure that low to moderate income community members have opportunities to learn the skills that they need to be effective in this industry. From this training, people will be exposed to other industries, particularly those in the union trades, and move on to full careers. A living wage paying job is transformational. It allows for stability in housing, education, and health. Northgate's goal to build such a training center where it is most needed is timely and will prove to be effective many times over. Here with me today is Jamez Staples, who's the president and CEO of Renewable Energy Partners, an additional partner in this project, who can discuss more details. Thank you.
All right. With that, Mr. Staples, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jamez Staples. I'm the CEO of Renewable Energy Partners and Northgate Development. And Renewable Energy Partners is a solar installation and development firm. Northgate Development is a real estate development firm. We're seeking to acquire these funds because, first of all, acknowledging that Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities in the country, opposed to sitting on the sidelines and admiring the problem like some have, I started Renewable Energy Partners in 2013, specifically to create jobs in the emerging clean energy sector to address the issue of disparities in education skills gap and to employment. Along the way on my first project, I recruited a couple people from my neighborhood to work with me on a solar project. While on the roof, I quickly realized the people working with me had no idea what they were doing. I realized they need to be trained. I asked where the training for clean energy and energy efficiency careers were, and after some investigating, I found the shortest commute, if you didn't have a car, was 2 hours away by transit. Being the problem solver that I am, instead of throwing my hands up, my colleagues and I went to work and started working to bring training to the community. We tried to get the state to use the building that they owned as a training center, which was located at 1200 Plymouth. At a certain point, the state decided to sell the building, so we stepped up and we purchased the property from the state and put it back on the tax rolls. The site sits along the highest use transit line in the state of Minnesota, which is now being converted to the D line, a bus rapid transit line that runs from Brooklyn Center to Bloomington that will stop every 10 minutes and pass through multiple cities. It's also a 5-minute bus ride from the Twin Stadium where the blue, green, and Southwest light rail line will, given this location, a regional access point. This is an amazing project. Since the acquisition of the property in December of 2017, we have done all that we could to make the building a living laboratory for science, technology, engineering, and math, and clean energy. While the building on the outside looks as though nothing has changed, there has been significant improvements. We've put on 174 kilowatts of solar on the roof, a battery storage system in partnership with the University of Minnesota that can be used as modeling for the first virtual power plant in North America if we can get the materials in time. Electric vehicle charging stations, a heat pump to put the gas utility on standby, and a complete stormwater retrofit that will manage all the stormwater. We're also serving as a field demonstration site for a number of new energy technologies and innovations, all designed to be teaching tools for the future workforce. I want to thank the legislature for last year's $2.5 million appropriation. We are grateful and appreciative for the vote of confidence to our mission of addressing climate change and poverty. As you all know, the state's fiscal year starts July 1st. We didn't get a contract finalized with DEED until November 24th. The first significant payout did not come until January 2nd or 3rd. The holidays and the resurgence of COVID really slowed things down. We are currently in the process of getting our interior design started and completed by this summer. To date, we have spent under 10% of the funds allocated from last year, but have seen significant increases. As regularly reported in the news, labor availability has been low, which has driven up the costs, and supplies, which is why we're back here today, seeking funds to offset those increases and also help ensure young people and underserved populations have access to skills training to get into the emerging fields of sustainability and clean energy. Contrary to popular belief, Northgate or Renewable Energy Partners does not run any training programming. Northgate's facility is, as described, one of the most accessible locations in the metropolitan area where we seek to make sure that young people and the underserved in North Minneapolis and surrounding communities can get access to training. What we are seeking to do is make sure that everyone has access to the skills to lift themselves up through education and training in the emerging fields of sustainability, and to get that training in a high-quality facility. I'm open to working with those who genuinely have an interest in working to get more black and brown people into the clean energy and climate change careers workspace. I personally reached out to various individuals and entities seeking to work with them and use some of the state funding from last year's appropriation to cover the cost of their programming so they too can have access to this underserved population. Our partners who have signed lease to occupy space and run programs include Avivo, which offers college credits in partnership with Project for Pride and Living, which offers youth programs for high school credits, working with 13 alternative high schools. Construction On-Ramp Exploration Corps, Minnesota STEM Partnerships, the City of Minneapolis, and their Green Exploration Program. And once the design is done and construction is complete, we are happy to allow entities that want access to this space and this population to share the training spaces. We've also engaged the Minnesota State College and Universities to help them meet their 2030 equity goals, and there has been a significant deal of interest. We have collectively applied for federal funding with the Minnesota State, and if awarded, we will host programmings for college credits also on the site. Public and utility funding to support electric vehicle infrastructure has to include training. We have created our own curriculum, and we are working on getting it certified by IREC, Interstate Renewable Energy Council. The goal is for one of our training partners to teach that program. These programs can be the entry point for workers that will build out the mobility hubs that must be built out for the City of Minneapolis and City of St. Paul and install EV infrastructure across the metropolitan area. The first $1 million in funding that we're requesting will help to offset the cost of the existing increases that we discussed already. One of the many entities we are working with, the College of Design at the University of Minnesota, is supporting us with two graduate students, and the director of the department is using a very small portion of his budget to support a minority architectural firm to start the pre-design. The balance of the $3 million is to cover the cost of pre-development, feasibility, design of the new 100,000 square foot facility that we're going to develop on the adjacent parking lot, which we planned for expansion of these programs. Thank you all for the opportunity to be here. We appreciate your vote of confidence previously.
Thank you so much, Mr. Staples, for your testimony. Only one quick question because we're moving.
We'll have more than that.
All right. Go ahead. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Staples, you mentioned that you've received $2.5 million from the state in the past and then other sources as well. So $3-4 million, whatever you have received so far, but very little, if anything, to show for it yet. Yet you're asking for more money. What have you actually accomplished? You talk about a building build out. Who owns that building?
My company, Northgate Development. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my company, Northgate Development, owns the property. Okay. And so as far as $4 million, I don't know where you're making that reference from. What I will say is that the funding that we have, that we did receive from various public sources, has went into the improvements that we made reference to. There's, like I said, 174 kilowatts of solar on the rooftop that was done in partnership with some of the trainees. In addition, a battery storage system, which would be the first of its kind in North America if completed quick enough. A stormwater retrofit, which we're managing 100% of the stormwater on site. A heat pump that's also powered by the solar and the battery that was basically up with the gas utility on standby. In addition to that, we've got electric vehicle charging stations on site. So that's where a lot of that money went to, all of that money went to.
Mr. Chair, but you said $2.5 million plus other government sources, so I assumed it'd be something north of $2.5 million. But that funding is going to a privately owned business. Is Northgate a nonprofit or is it a
corporate for-profit entity, social enterprise? I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there are many programs out there already. Helmets to Hard Hats, Building Strong Communities, there are community colleges that provide this training. Our building trades have training facilities. What do you provide that they don't? What need are you meeting that's not being met currently?
Mr. Staples, be brief, and then we'll move on to House File 1200 because of the time that I've allocated for this bill.
Absolutely, Chair.
It's going to go to the capital investment.
Absolutely. So what we're doing is we're actually located where people can get to these programs. If you listen to my testimony, we made it very clear that some of these sites that these programs are offered at are roughly 2 hours by transit to get to. And so what we want to do is make sure that the populations that are actually going to represent 70% of the workforce in the next 10 years have access to these programs so they can participate in the emerging sectors of the economy. So, you know, that's what we're doing different. We're basically providing space to make sure that people can get to it. When you talk about a training center, if your training center is in St. Michael and people live in Minneapolis and there's no public transit to get them there, good luck. having the workforce of the future. I also served on the Energy Utility Diversity Group in 2019 with a 2020 report that came out. And basically, what came of that report, it's basically, you can find it, I can send it to you if you'd like, Representative, is that we need access to programming. We need to target, focus on opportunity zones. And those are underserved populations that don't have the necessary resources. They need to be on transit. They need to be, and we're talking about energy, which is a foundational component of our whole infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. Staples. I know we have got a bill that we have to bring forward, so I appreciate you being here, and thanks to the bill author. With that, I just wanted to invite Chair Richardson. We are moving to House File 1200. I move that House File be referred to Ways and Means Committee. With that, welcome Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I see I've got A7 amendment.
Correct.
I move the adoption of A7 amendment. If you can briefly explain the A7 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The A7 amendment makes some technical corrections. I will speak to the substantive changes that the amendment makes. It amends some definitions. The definition of family member is amended to match that in federal legislation. It also requires the commissioner to engage in rulemaking, and it increases an applicant's right to appeal from 20 calendar days after the sending of a determination, an amended determination, or an overpayment to 30 days or within 60 days if an applicant can establish good cause for not appealing within 30 days. And that good cause analysis would consider factors related to disability, linguistic, and literacy limitations as well. The amendment clarifies what constitutes verbal notice from an employee to an employer about the need for leave. And it also makes a number of date changes. The most substantive ones related to that is it shifts the timeline of reviewing annual private plans from October to December. It updates the annual premium rates collection from January 1st, 2023 to 2025. It updates that beginning in fiscal year 2025, the commissioner can use 0.5% of revenue for outreach, education, and technical assistance, and shifts the timeline for the annual reports from the commissioner to MMB. The amendment adds a one-time appropriation of $1.7 billion in fiscal year 2023 from the general fund to DEED. That would support family medical leave benefits for two calendar years, and also implementation and administration costs as well. Those funds would be available until June 30th, 2026, and any unspent funds would cancel back to the general fund. And with that, I will just note that it also states that family and medical benefits may be applied for starting January 1st, 2024. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Discussions, members? See none. All those in favor of adoption of A7 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The A7 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Chair Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will mark the second time that we have heard House File 1200 here related to paid family medical leave. I do have a testifier here with me today that I would like to yield my time to.
Chair Richardson.
Who's the chair? Who's testifying?
Oh, we have. I'm looking forward to see if the Attorney General is online.
Chair Noor.
Angelica, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My name is Angelica Klevish. I serve the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General as Senior Advisor in Special Projects and Public Policy. Attorney General has a scheduling conflict and sends his apologies, but he's asked me to provide remarks on his behalf. Is that okay?
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Very well. So my name is Angelica Klevish. I'm the Senior Advisor in Special Projects and Public Policy. Chair Noor, Vice Chair Xiong, Ranking Member Hamilton, and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing our office to offer a brief testimony in support of House File 1200. The Attorney General's main goal is to help Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. But across the country and in Minnesota, women face barriers to economic security and prosperity every day. That's why the Attorney General created a task force to identify in concrete terms how systems are failing women in the workplace and what opportunities exist to remove barriers to their full participation in our economy. The Advisory Task Force on Expanding the Economic Security of Women in Minnesota brought together 22 people with a breadth of expertise, experience, and community relationships. After almost a year of learning and thinking together, they recently provided our office with 115 recommendations for improving conditions for women in the state. I'll be sure to send you a copy of the report, which is also available on our website. Our office is committed to advancing the recommendations of the task force, and among their top recommendations is supporting paid family medical leave. As you know, the Women's Economic Security Act of 2014 requires employers to provide 12 weeks of unpaid pregnancy and parenting leave within 12 months of the birth or adoption of a child. It also allows the use of pregnancy leave if an employee cannot work because of prenatal, pregnancy, childbirth, or related health conditions. However, for many families, especially low-income families, unpaid leave is simply not an option. Forcing pregnant women to work through the end of their pregnancies or through a time where they need to recover from the physical, mental, and emotional toll of birth and parenting. Not providing paid family leave can also shorten the critical bonding time following childbirth or adoption because of a family's financial needs. In this country, families should not be forced to choose between caring for themselves and their families when urgent medical needs arise and having to return to work because their financial needs must be prioritized regardless of what they are going through. What's great about House File 1200 is that it provides several avenues for businesses to make this critical accommodation for their workers, including creating supportive grants for small businesses. I said I would be very brief, and so, Mr. Chair, thank you and members for your attention and for the chance to share a small part of our task force's work with you today. I'll close by asking you to support House File 1200 because when women can access economic opportunities fully and without barriers, our entire society benefits. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Klevish, for your testimony on behalf of the Attorney General. The next person is, I've got Ms. Samantha Sensimora. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, committee members. My name is Samantha Sensimura. I am the executive director of 826 MSP, an educational nonprofit that offers free in-school and out-of-school writing, publishing, and leadership programs to students in grades K-12 in the Twin Cities. We are a growing organization with a budget about $500,000. I was the first person to use our 8-week paid family and medical leave policy in the summer of 2021 when my son, Tadashi, was born 5 weeks early due to my having developed preeclampsia. His birth was dangerous, it was unexpected, it was sudden, and in the end, he had to spend 2.5 weeks in the NICU while he adjusted and learned to eat on his own. I ended up taking 10 weeks of leave, which meant I only had 7.5 weeks once my son came home from the hospital. It was absolutely not enough time. I came back to work feeling both emotionally fragile and unable to be fully present or successful in my role. I felt like I was failing on two fronts. I felt inadequate at work, and I felt guilty for leaving my son. Our current system for family leave leaves everyone falling short. Our small businesses and organizations like mine who desperately want to support and nurture our employees but can't afford to, and our employees like myself who are forced to make decisions between work and family that no one should have to make. We need a comprehensive system that understands that families come in many different forms, that being able to care for family is an essential need, and that employers want to support families during critical moments but need support to do so. That is why I support paid family and medical leave, and I ask that this committee moves forward and votes for House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Christy Hall. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christy Hall, and I'm here today to testify in support of HF 1200. I'm the senior staff attorney at Gender Justice, a nonprofit advocacy organization based in St. Paul. And I'm testifying in support of the bill's family definition that's inclusive and honors the diversity of ways that Minnesotans create their families. Respecting chosen family is critical for all people, particularly for those of us in the LGBTQ community. The pandemic has certainly revealed to all of us the urgent need for an inclusive definition of family. We've seen the patchwork nature of our care systems and how important community of all kinds has been to our survival. My immediate family, my siblings and nibblings, live out of state. Had I contracted COVID or suffered from any other illness in the last few years, I would have turned to my close friends for caregiving support. They would have not fallen into the standard family definition. Gender Justice is proud of HF 1200 because it contributes to gender equity in the workplace and in our communities. We've seen how families and communities are putting together support, and we should not create unnecessary obstacles for Minnesotans to provide and receive care however their families are formed. That's why the paid family and medical leave bills moving through the Senate right now that are oriented towards tax credits and private insurance companies are incredibly insufficient. We can do better. HF 1200 is that better solution for all Minnesotans. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the family and gender equity affirming benefits of this bill. And I'd also direct you to look at my executive director, Megan Peterson, who submitted written comments about the importance of an inclusive family definition to her family. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christy Hall, for your testimony. Appreciate that. The next person is Kennedy. Please.
Thank you very much, Chair Noor. Can you hear and see me?
Yes, Ms. Kennedy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Wonderful. Thank you. My name is Dana Kennedy. I'm a leader with ISAIAH, and I live in St. Paul. When I was first diagnosed with cancer, our daughter was five. I was in a coma, and I was in the hospital for more than 5 weeks. I had to learn how to walk again, how to button a shirt. I was in and out of the hospital for months. Because I left my job, we needed my husband's income. With no paid family medical leave, he couldn't afford to take even one day off of work. Steve had to visit me in the hospital, meet with doctors, cook, clean, shop, take care of a five-year-old, and go to work every day. And our five-year-old couldn't even cross a busy street by herself to get to kindergarten. We were in crisis. Our daughter told us recently she had to wear dirty underwear for days because Steve had no time to do any laundry. Regents Hospital called him twice to tell him I might not make it, but he couldn't come. Families are facing much worse because they can't take time from work to care for a loved one. Minnesotans across race, across gender and geography are left to deal with life and death situations, to make life and death decisions with no time to even think straight. This is why a paid family and medical leave policy that's left to private insurers or tax credits or other partial measures, such as not including medical leave, is not the answer. House File 1200 is. I ask you to please move it through your committee. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kennedy, for your testimony. The next person is Sarah Pippenberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Pippenberg, and I'm the co-owner of Vinaigrette, a family-owned food store located in southwest Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Main Street Alliance. 4 years ago, one of our most valued long-term employees, Linda, fell and broke both of her arms. She was unable to work. If she went without her paycheck from us while she was out recovering, she was going to have to choose between putting food on the table and making rent. But I've told this story many times right here. We paid her while she was out because it was the right thing to do, but we were late on our commercial rent and our house payment. It was a real struggle. My story with Linda continued as Linda went on to be diagnosed with ALS and died May 4th last year. Interestingly enough, I testified at her bedside on May 3rd for paid leave with an omnibus bill. To think if there had been a paid leave plan in place, her grandson could have sat with her the last week of her life, if only to hold her hand as she passed on. It was me. I held her hand as she passed on, and I'm thankful it was me. But it was me because my small business has been suffering because of COVID. We looked into different private insurance plans and options when we opened Vinaigrette, and again, when I was challenged at a previous hearing on paid leave. I took that challenge and met with three different agents. However, their premiums were more costly than what the premiums would be under a statewide paid family and medical leave program. The programs also required a minimal hospital stay, excluded coverage for cancer, didn't give paid family leave to those that adopted. In my experience, the private market options were unaffordable and substandard. A small tax that I can plan for that will allow each and every working Minnesotan access to paid family and medical leave is a plan as a small business owner I can support. This shouldn't be such a struggle for any of us. House File 1200, a statewide paid family and medical leave program, creates a system where everyone pays in a little and everyone benefits. It would provide a safety net for us, help us attract and retain dedicated employees like Linda, and do so much more. A private paid leave program would create further barriers to paid leave through cost and accessibility. I urge members of this committee to support House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is McDowell. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is LaSharon McDonald. I am a home visitor and with the Minnesota Breastfeeding Coalition and the Birth Equity Community Council, which is dedicated to advocating for paid and family leave. I became pregnant with my second child during my sophomore year of college. This was an exhausting time in my life. I was dealing with fatigue, hormonal changes, and the demands of taking care of my infant son 24/7. I was parenting, dealing with postpartum symptoms, and being a full-time student. I was not able to drop down to part-time because of financial aid. When my son was about 2 months old, I had to go to the ER due to uncontrollable bleeding. The hospital was able to stop the bleeding, and I was sent home. I truly believe that I was under too much stress and never really had time to heal and bond with my baby. All of it made my postpartum recovery longer and worse. I felt like a zombie every day for the first 4 months of my son's life. As a home visitor, I serve families who must return to work soon after delivery to keep the bills paid. For most parents, financial stress is the number one factor for returning to work right after delivery. Parents need time to stay home and bond with their newborn. We know that a longer maternity leave correlates to a longer duration of breastfeeding. We want every baby to have access to their mother's breast milk. PFML would benefit the families I work with. It would also benefit these families to get these benefits sooner. That's why I'm excited that the House wants to put $1.7 billion into it on the front end. Please support House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. McDowell, for your testimony. The next person is Dell Dobbin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Richardson, ranking members, and committee. My name is Dr. Dale Dobrin. I'm a pediatrician with the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and with Doctors for Early Childhood. I wish to testify in favor of paid family leave. As a pediatrician, I'm aware that many low-income families and BIPOC families struggle with the effects of poverty. These effects are most notable when income is most compromised, as when parents are unable to work while they recover after giving birth. This results in considerable stress on the young family. which Dr. Sean Koff, a pediatrician and director of the Harvard Center for the Developing Child, says is equivalent to chronic toxic stress. Chronic toxic stress, as in hand-to-mouth existence of families when unable to work, is often transmitted from parent to baby during the critical first 6 to 12 weeks following a baby's birth. A great start is thus preempted by this stress. The first 3 years after birth is a time when the brain reaches 80+% of its size and its foundations are often set for life. Brains are poised from the moment of birth to learn from the baby's environment. Recent brain science tells us that a young brain under stress does not grow and develop properly, leading to changes in brain structure, which lead to functional impairments from which many children never fully recover. This leads to school struggles, often school failure, mental health problems, substance abuse issues, poor health, early death, and even incarcerations. Paid leave during the crucial first 6 to 12 weeks after a baby's born can provide relief from these stresses, leading to the calm nurturing which all babies need and all parents desire. Only 30% of Minnesotans receive any type of paid leave, and the vast majority of low-income families receive none. 50% of all births in Minnesota are covered by Medicaid, the state's medical assistance program. In a time of great surplus, more than $9 billion, Minnesota can and must do better. The Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and Doctors for Early Childhood fully support paid family leave legislation at this time, because babies and toddlers and parents can't wait. As an added bonus, a parent is then able to return to a job waiting, which helps businesses thrive and economies grow. This is true in all corners of Minnesota, especially in rural communities, whose very existence depends on these parents, babies, families, and businesses. Before I finish, I just want to say how touched I've been by the stories of the other testifiers, which only go to further endorse the need, which has been present for way too long, for a bill like House File 1200, which, again, we fully support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dobwin. With that, start with discussion. Member discussion, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Richardson, I know I joked with you when this bill was up in a previous committee about we should just rename this the GoFundMe bill. But that's kind of how I feel this bill is, because, you know, the summer when I had my accident, my husband had to stay home because I was in the hospital for a week and I had to take care of the kiddo. And then when I got out of the hospital, he had to go right back to work. I had to rely on family to come over and drive me back and forth to medical appointments, to take care of my daughter. And I relied on you guys, you know. You all stepped up and helped me out in my time of need. And I'm lucky, but not everybody is that lucky. And so I think that this is just one of those things that, and I know I say this with the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, is not all people have the support system that my family has. To make sure that we get a really good start, or that we can care for our loved ones, or, you know, just having, you know, people to cry on a shoulder of. And so this is really where I see kind of, you know, us being that support system. And this is at the very least that we can do to make sure that everybody can, you know, care for their wife when she cuts off her fingers with the chainsaw. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Cagle. Any further discussion, members? Online? Members, this is a critical program. We have seen the pandemic, the impact, particularly for women and many people who are struggling every single day. I think this is an overdue. It's past time. It's time for us to act and pass paid family medical leave. And I think this is, we will be on the record in the history of what we do when we're called upon to do the right thing. Members, this is the right thing at the right time, and the right opportunity is today, and we shall act With that, I think Representative Baker wanted to give us more comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we have seen this bill come around a number of times the last couple of years, there's a lot of parts about this bill as an employer that I really do like. Our stories today are real. You know, we have these amazing reasons why people need time off from work. And again, I understand that. What I wished would happen here, and I wish that Representative Richardson would have gotten serious about this bill to a place where we could do something instead of throwing everything in the kettle, 24 weeks, for everybody that's extended, that this list of people that could be included is very broad. And as an employer, as I've seen it along the way, this is going to be a reason why employers really push back, is because it's so broad. There's no guide, there's hardly any guardrails here. And it concerns us that knowing the other body isn't really taking this bill at all, but we could have done really something for moms having babies. That is one area we all, I think, can get behind. That's an area to start walking before we grab it all. And I just, and again, I say this because this is, some components of this are right. But when you ask for so much and you do very little to talk to the organizations that really will have, I think, have really good things to advise and consult, and let's try to see something, but let's not do double what the federal government is doing here. There's a lot of things about the federal government that aren't bad either, but we're overreaching, and I guess that's my point here, members, is that it's not a bad concept to have businesses step up for new moms and new dads. That's not it. The doctor that was just on, he had some very good things to say. I totally agree with a lot of parts of this, but we have got to get serious about writing this in this moment in our timelines after COVID. Businesses are you're going to hear stories and everything. Corporate profits are over the top. You bet they are in some cases, but they are not in my world. They are not in the hospitality industry. They are not in a lot of areas. So you can't just run all of those with a real broad stroke. And I know, Mr. Chair, you've given this bill a lot of attention and a lot of time. We need to get unemployment insurance passed, because that's important too. We're spending a lot of time on this, and I know this will pass. And when this thing kind of passes the House, it'll reach the House floor, and it'll get out of here before unemployment insurance will. And we have a lot of things we got to work on. But I just want to say to members, if you really want to get serious about writing legislation that will actually pass and actually do some good things, it's okay to take some smaller chunks of a bill to make this work. And I hope we remember that. I remember writing the opioid stuff with Representative Olson and others. We couldn't do the whole thing, but we kept working on it. We kept fighting through the parts that of the people that hated the bill and people that supported the bill. But we got to something, and we got to have something pretty magical. But it was a major bill. This is a major bill. And I just don't think that it has had the scrutiny of all parties at the table to say what is reasonable and what's realistic this year. And I want to be a part of this again. I want to be something to be a part of something that we can do in the future. So I wish I could support this, but I just can't the way it is at this moment. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Devin, and then we'll go to Representative Olson on the other side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I'm interested in the small bites approach. You're in hospitality. The appetizers.
Yes.
The appetizer course approach. My mother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer about 9-10 months ago. She died in January. In November, my wife went to be at her side to support her during some of her chemotherapy treatment. Under your appetizer approach, was it my wife who didn't deserve access to paid family and medical leave to be by her stepmother's side, or is it my stepmother who didn't deserve my wife being at her side?
Is that a question?
So, President Baker, let me get to Olson, and then do you want a response?
I was hoping for a response. I mean, we don't have the tradition of asking to yield in committee. I can certainly
absolutely
do that if the chair prefers.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dabney, that's a great question. Let's get to the bottom of it. I mean, they all have a right to be there, but let's take these little steps at a time. I'm saying is we can't do it all for 24 weeks or whatever the number is. To such an extended side of things, whether somebody's living with you for a year, whether it's, you know, is it stepdaughters, is it ex-in-laws? I just want to know, where does that sort of the guardrails kind of fit in? I want people to be together at the end of those days, and I want people to be with their babies when they're just born, and for everything in between. But we've got to find a way to start. Where do we start first? Where are, because they're all priorities, I get it. But if you want to think about doing this at this level at all times, I fear we will never get there, because we're asking for not only the appetizer, we want the salad, the dessert, the entree, and another entree, and then we want the whole restaurant. That's where I see this is becoming too much. And so we all have a right, but we should sit down and talk about what's the right approach to this. Thank you.
Chair, just a brief response. Reverend Baker, you indicated that Chair Richardson had not taken this bill seriously. And I can assure you, from having watched her work on this bill and all the effort of many legislators on my side of the aisle, she and we take Minnesota families and their needs extremely seriously. You also raised the lack of engagement by the majority in the other body. I think if you want to see progress for Minnesota families, I would urge you to take your privileged position as a member of that party and get them to take Minnesota families seriously. Come to the table, engage, negotiate, and help find common answers. The lack of their engagement is an indictment of them, not of Representative Richardson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. And I just wanted to remind the body that we passed the paid family medical leave on the floor. This bill that you're looking at, we passed it. It's still not yet enacted in the other body. And for less than a cup of coffee, Liz Olson, and then we'll go to the vote for the bill. Representative Olson. We can get to her. Chair Richardson, I renew the motion, House File 1200, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. The Committee Legislative Assistant will now take the roll.
Chair Noor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Zhang?
Aye.
Lead Hamilton?
No.
Baker?
No.
Dabney?
Dabney, aye.
Frankie?
No.
Greenman?
Aye.
Haley?
No.
Juergens?
No.
Cagle?
Aye.
Katiza Watun?
Aye.
Olson? Olson? Zhang?
Aye.
Olson? Olson? Chair Noor, there are 7 ayes and 5 nays.
With 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion is adopted, and the bill is on the way to Ways and Means, and we'll have more conversation there. Members, we do have one other bill, and we wanted to proceed with that bill next on Wednesday, so we don't have to wait. And with that, members, we don't have any other bills in front of us until on Wednesday. We are now adjourned. Thank you so much. Thank you.